Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to Drinking the Kool-Aid.
Welcome.
I'm Megan.
I'm Hannah.
And I made a mistake.
Stop.
Okay.
No. Megan.
It was a small-ish one.
You know what? No. Yeah. I'm Isaac, if you're listening, you're going to need to make us a tune.
Yeah.
So that Megan can just chime in with the little tune and be like, my bad, made a mistake, here's the fix, okay, we're done.
Yeah.
We'll just do a little tune from now on, and then she'll just say her mistake, and then we'll just move on with it.
Welcome to Megan's mess-ups.
Yeah, no, I'll have to see, yeah, Isaac, we're gonna need, like, a little tune for that, so get on it, please, thank you.
So
okay, love you.
When I was editing the first part of this story, it sounded as if I was kind of switching back and forth when I was talking about one of the victims. I was saying like Peloso and Pelosa for her last name.
It's Leviosa.
Oh my gosh. So I just wanted to make sure that I said it correctly because she is a victim. So it was Silvina Peloso.
Okay.
There you go.
Got it.
So if you're like, why are you switching back and forth? I don't know.
That, you know, it's all right. It'd be like that.
Yeah. I just like cringed. I was like, why did you do that?
I mean, you have to cringe at least once per editing, right? To be like, why did I do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I watched for this episode Captive Audience, A Real American Horror Story, Episode 3, and FBI Criminal Pursuit, Season 1, Episode 9, Trail of Terror. I also read the book In the Name of the Children by Jeffrey L. Reinick and Merrilee Strong. And again, this is the case of the Yosemite Killer.
I have not forgotten.
Good. So, little recap of the first one.
She's gonna blow your brain apart.
Whoa! Carol Sund, her daughter Julie Sund, and her friend Silvina Peloso were staying at Cedar Lodge in Yosemite. The women had done some hiking and exploring in the park, and they were going to leave the next day to catch a flight to Arizona with Carol's husband, Jens, but they never arrived. They had all gone missing on February 15th of 1999, and investigators locked up a group of people that they believed were responsible for this. On March 18th, Carol's rented vehicle was discovered, and it had been torched up. Two bodies were in the trunk, and they were identified as Carol and Silvina. The FBI received a letter in the mail with a hand-drawn map that said, "We had fun with this one." The map led them to Julie's body. It was announced that the park was deemed safe again, as all the main players were in jail. But on the morning of July 21st, Joey Armstrong was murdered just outside her cabin. There were tire tracks at the scene of the crime, and witnesses saw a blue International Scout with white stripes, which belonged to Carrie Stainer, the brother of kidnapped victim Stephen Stainer.
And mind blown apart.
Yes. Carrie was questioned and was hesitant to allow investigators to search his backpack. Once he was brought down to the police station, Carrie told Agent Reinick that he had struggled with thoughts of trapping young girls in a bunker and molesting them since he was 6 or 7 years old. His family had been riddled with mental illness and sexual abuse that went back 5 generations. And he said he could provide a confession if Agent Reinick gave him a large stack of child pornography. And that is where we left off in the first one.
Truthfully, I don't know how you were able to hold this all in, because I'm going to tell you what.
Yeah.
I literally had such a hard time not telling, like, the group of, like, people that I hang out with basically every day. Like, I started almost saying it the other day, and I was like, oh, I can't tell you. You have to listen to all of them first.
I know.
But it was so freaking difficult. And so I only, like, dropped a little itsy bitsy bomb and then just like left it there so that they would want to listen. And like sure should have like, wait, which episode was that? So I need to listen to this one and this one. And I'm like, yes, so that I can fucking talk about it.
Yeah, this one is just really crazy. And I definitely wanted to keep the stories separate because they are separate stories. They're, you know, everyone wants to bunch them in because Stephen and Carrie are brothers. But I almost think that that overshadows the hero that Stephen was.
Yes.
Because Carrie is so bad.
Yep.
So that's why once I like found out, I was like, oh, we're gonna just, you know, do those in their own time.
No, I just can't wait till they're released so that I can finally talk about it because yeah. It's in my brain and it is driving me nuts.
I know. Now you know how I felt.
Torture.
Woo. When Stephen Stainer, now, of course, we already talked about Stephen Stainer. We did a 4-part, you know, little episode series on him. But when he was kidnapped in 1972, he was held for 7 years. Carrie, as the older brother, felt that he was actually partially responsible for not protecting him. Psychiatrist Park Dietz was hired by the prosecution to evaluate whether Carrie was sane or not. And Carrie told him that as a child, he worried that all of his obsessive thoughts about holding their neighbor girl against her will was somehow what caused Stephen to be kidnapped.
Oh, like he manifested it?
Exactly.
Oh.
And that is a really interesting take on it. And he was a child at this time. So, I mean, just to know that that's running through his head, like, oh, I'm obsessed with doing something similar to the neighbor, so now it happened to my brother.
By the way, as a quick side note, if you haven't listened to the Stephen Stainer episodes, like, seriously, pause and go listen.
Because please go back, yeah.
Absolutely incredible stories.
And like,
so incredible, you have no idea.
It'll really make a lot more sense, too.
Yes,
as
that's
you're going
very true.
Through these.
Yep.
And one of the things I wanted to bring up, I didn't write it in, you know, our story, but I was thinking about it today. And when we covered the Stephen Stainer case, there's a part in there, I believe it was in maybe the last episode, where Stephen comes home and Carrie is talking about how, you know, he used to go out and wish on a star for his brother to come back. And then when his brother came back, he went out and thanked a star instead.
Yes, I remember that.
And it's like, thinking about that, like, we were both going, oh my gosh, that's so sweet.
Like, the sweetest thing ever, yeah.
And then to see what he turned into.
And, yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
And it's, like, almost like, yeah, it's just, like, creepy.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about that, like, it is, I think it's just mind-blowing in general to know that his brother was taken and then that was, like, something he was fantasizing about. That is just absolutely insane to me.
And for him to experience firsthand what it does to a family when something like that happens.
Exactly.
And then he still wants to do that to other people and then goes on to murder others.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Ugh. And there are more people that are potentially believed to be his victims than what we're going to discuss.
Okay.
But there's not direct links to him. It's more of like, oh, it could be. He could have been in the area.
Okay.
So that's why we're not really going into those. He didn't confess to them either. So his parents, Del and Kay, testified that they both withdrew emotionally after Stephen went missing. Del said that he put all of his time and efforts into finding his son, then he fell into a depression with thoughts of suicide. He pushed Carrie away and said things like, quote, his real son was gone.
Oh, no.
Which is obviously very damaging to a child. Kay said that her own father told her to view Stephen's kidnapping as a good thing because now she had fewer children to worry about.
Whoa.
And money was tight. So it was kind of like, oh, well, now there's one less that you have to, you know, feed and clothe. Whoa. That's a really interesting thing to say.
I wish I had words to respond to that with, but I just truly don't.
It's really disgusting because at this point, when he was first kidnapped, they obviously assumed he could have been murdered. And so you're saying, like, well, it's a good thing maybe that he got taken and potentially killed.
Well, not even that, but like he could, I mean, he was being tortured in a form, you know, and it's like he could have been like tortured in so much worse ways too. And that could have just been happening. And you're just like, meh, one less mouth.
Right. Don't got to feed that one.
Like, frick, man, these aren't farm animals. My God.
So, I mean, that's the kind of mentality that they're growing up with and dealing with here. And Kay's father also told her that she couldn't cry or show any emotion because she would appear crazy like her mother.
Great.
So she followed his advice and raised her children with a lack of emotion.
That's super.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right up there with people telling men that they shouldn't be able to show emotion.
Right.
It's fucking stupid.
Yeah, I mean, give me a break. Besides the child pornography, Kerry made another demand during the interrogation. He wanted his family to receive the $250,000 reward the Carrington family had offered, and he wanted to be housed in a federal prison being built near his hometown of Merced. He explained that his parents were not very well off. His dad lost his job at the cannery, and his parents had to give up their home, and they were living in a trailer outside Merced. He also had a nephew confined to a wheelchair who needed help. Reinick told him that he could not promise either of these things. And it's like, in what universe does a killer's own family
get the money from him being the murderer?
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think it works that way.
Not quite.
Reinick told him that what he really needed to do was prioritize his demands. What was the most important thing to him? And he said it was the child pornography.
Are you serious?
That was his number one request. And in fact, it was a deal breaker for his confession.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Uh-huh. So there it is. He is not that concerned about his family. He just wants that porn. And he said he didn't just want to see a few pictures.
Oh, God.
He wanted a big stack, and it better include videos. Kerry claimed... Yeah.
It's making my stomach turn.
It is horrifying here. Kerry claimed he had never seen child pornography because he had been too afraid to seek it out. And it certainly wasn't as accessible as it is nowadays.
Okay, I'm sorry. You're too afraid to seek out child porn, you'll murder people?
Uh-huh. I know. I was like, okay, Kerry.
I mean, both things are atrocious, but are you kidding me? Like, you were too afraid to do that, but you will take somebody's life from them?
Mm-hmm. And he didn't have a computer, so it is very possible he wasn't seeking it out, but I don't think it's because he was afraid.
It's just...
I truly don't.
Oh, man.
He said, quote, "It's just something that's closure for me in that respect."
Ugh! Mm-hmm. Oh, God, no!
He says, "It's perverted, it's sick, it's disgusting, I know all of these things, but it's just, it's gotta be one of the conditions. Otherwise, I can't go to prison for the rest of my life and, sorry to say, be happy."
First off, those words don't even begin to cover the situation.
And second, I really don't care if you're happy.
I don't want you to be fucking happy. Yeah. I want you to be miserable.
Absolutely.
For the rest of your life.
I'm not going to give you child pornography so you could be happy.
Fuck.
That's gross. Agent Reinick says that Kerry did have at least one experience with child pornography that had a very profound effect on him. The uncle, who sexually abused him when he was a child, used pictures of naked girls in a magazine to groom him and some of his other male cousins. In his interview with Dr. Dietz, Kerry said he was, quote, "enthralled" by a particular picture of naked girls who were around 10 to 11 years old. He mentioned the same photo during a recorded phone call he made to someone from jail, and he said he had been fixated on that image ever since he saw it.
I literally just got done showering right before the podcast, and I'm feeling like I need a shower after this.
I really hate talking about child porn. Like,
yeah, no, I just feel like
it's
really
just
gross.
Disgusting.
Yeah, I just like feel really gross, and I just like I feel like I need to just get straight back in the shower after this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I really feel bad for Agent Reinick, who had to sit there and listen to this and act like he was unaffected by it, because he even talks about that in the book, how he has to not show emotion or disgust. Yep. Because then you're not going to get the confession.
Right. And like reason 5 gazillion that I could never be a fucking cop. And
no.
Because I would jump across that table and wring his neck right there.
Exactly. But no, he has to just sit there and be like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there ain't, no. I would like, you would have to remove me from that room so fast. Like,
we would suck at that.
Oh, so bad.
Agent Reinick wondered if Carrie actually had something to do with the murders, or if he was scamming them to get to the child pornography. The FBI had already made arrests in the Sund Peloso murders, and they seemed real confident that they had the right guys. So that's why he's like, is this real? You know? Reinick told Carrie about this and asked why he should even believe him. He said he could offer some facts that would convince them that he's the guy and that no one else was involved in this. Reinick decided to play the game, and he told Carrie he was going to give him one word, and if he was truly involved, he should know the significance of that word. So Reinick said, bank. This was referring to Carol Sun's account, but Carrie was confused by this and knew nothing about the bank activity.
Oh, shit.
Reinick was like, listen, we get people to falsely confess all the time. Carrie said, quote, I didn't use any of the cards. I threw them out the window. There was no bank ever involved. Reinick told him to give them something that nobody else could know about. And Carrie said, quote, shaved pubic hair.
Oh, God.
Uh-huh. Now, Reinick did not work the case from start to finish here. So he didn't know anything about this. So he asked Carrie if he had ever done something anonymously. Carrie said, quote, wrote a letter. He explained that he sent a letter to the FBI at the Doubletree Motel in Modesto. The letter and map to Julie's body had never been publicized. Reinick told him that his family had already been victimized when Steven Stainer was kidnapped. Now they were going to be victimized again. And Carrie said, quote, by me this time. He hung his head and started crying. Reinick told him that one of the conditions had been to look out for his family. So maybe that's the condition that they should prioritize. Reinick offered to personally break the news to his parents before they found out by the media. He could prepare them for what would be coming next and maybe even try to comfort them a little. Reinick asked how hard it would be for his family if he had to tell him that tell them that before doing the right thing, their son demanded child pornography. Carrie asked, well, what would the harm be in at least showing him some child pornography?
What?
I mean, compared to all the murders.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that's how he puts it.
Well.
Reinick asked him if he would be willing to tell him about Joey's murder while they waited to hear back from the U.S. attorney about his request, and he agreed. Carrie began by talking about his love for Yosemite Park. He had been going there all his life and went there as a kid with his family.
Yeah, I've been hearing that name a lot lately.
You have. In fact, in part 3 of Steven Stainer's story, I mentioned that when Steven was going to be returned to his family, Carrie was camping with some friends in Yosemite.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. He claimed that he saw Bigfoot in a barn in Foresta in 1982, and he heard the barn had been rebuilt when he was spending an afternoon sunbathing nude on July 21st, 1999. So he decided to go check it out. Foresta Road ends at a little bridge just past Joey's house. It had been washed out, so vehicles could no longer cross it. Carrie stopped at the bridge to throw rocks into the creek, and he saw Joey carrying duffel bags from the greenhouse to her truck. Carrie said, quote, "And I just noticed her. There she is, you know, fairly attractive girl." He believed that she was alone, but he wanted to verify, so he walked up the street past her house towards the barn. As he walked back, he began talking to her. He calls this, quote, "doing research."
Oh, God.
But in reality, it's stalking. That's what it's really called.
Wait, what the fuck did Bigfoot have to do with anything? Is that the only reason he was supposedly there?
That's what he claims.
I was like, what? Where did Bigfoot come from?
So he actually has an obsession with Bigfoot.
Okay. No, I was just, I was wondering why Bigfoot was in the barn in particular. Because, like, you know, I've said it many times. Like, I fully believe there could be something out there like Bigfoot. Like,
of course.
Parts of this planet we haven't even gone near, you know, like
we don't have a clue what's out there.
There's things that could be hiding, no problem, but I just was wondering why Bigfoot was in a barn and why he just came out of nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, he had talked about Bigfoot a lot to people, and so he had supposedly seen Bigfoot in this area.
Okay,
and that's how he explains that he found himself there. I don't know that that's entirely true, but
I was just intrigued by it.
I know. So Joey was on the porch watering her plants, and Carrie told her how long he'd been coming to Yosemite. He had seen her house many times, but he didn't know anyone lived there. As he spoke, he moved closer to her. He told Joey that he had seen Bigfoot in the area and asked if she had ever seen the creature or heard anything about it. She said no, but perhaps her roommate had. Carrie asked if anyone else was there. Maybe they could go ask if they've seen anything. And that's when she said she was home alone.
Always say yes. Always say yes.
Yeah. The moment she turned her back to him, he pulled out a gun from the back of his waistband. She saw the gun, and Carrie shoved her into the house and duct taped her hands behind her back and gagged her with tape. He told her she was not going to get hurt if she cooperated. He was just there for money. But she kept fighting and managed to rip through the bindings twice. Carrie gripped her by the arm and walked her to the truck that was parked down by the bridge. As they passed her truck, he took the keys that she had left in the trunk. They were sitting in the trunk lock, and then he shut the open hatch. When they got to his scout, he lifted her into the back seat and tried to get her to lie down so that he could cover her with a sleeping bag. He said he was planning to take her to the back side of a hill, away from other homes in Foresta, to rape her. He flipped a U-turn, but as he drove, she kept fighting, kicking, and screaming through the gag and trying to sit up. Carrie started to panic because he was losing control, so he pulled a knife from his back pocket and threatened her, but Joey didn't stop fighting. He had only driven about 200 to 300 yards, and she was able to catapult herself headfirst out the open passenger side window.
Oh my God.
I mean, this girl, holy hell. Once she landed on the ground, she got to her feet and started running. They were close to other cabins, but Carrie took off after her. When he caught up to her, he tried to drag her down to a secluded area, but she fought the whole time. He knew he was not going to get what he wanted, so he took out a knife and slit her throat.
Do you know what actually like fucking horrifies me? I think about this all the time. I am always like thinking about like if I were to be in a situation like this, like how scary it is not only to be in the situation, obviously, but to not know what type of person you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Because like if you know, if you watch anything, like you can get a decent idea of like the different types of personalities that typically like are, you know, like involved in this type of situation.
And a lot of them get scared. They'll stop.
Yeah. But it's so scary when they're like, oh, well, if you cooperate, then I won't do anything, because sometimes that's true and sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
And it's like, how the hell do you know which one it is? You know, like sometimes it's better for you to actually play along with the role that they're giving you, or, you know, sometimes it's better to not play along at all. And it's like, it's just so horrifying because you don't know which one you're supposed to do.
But anytime going to another location, that's no.
Yeah, no, you literally,
you
yes.
know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's very true. But it's just like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, it's crazy yeah. to think about because you're just like, how the hell in that situation are you supposed to know which one it is?
But I can say with this person, with certainty, even if she would have played along, yeah, he was going to kill her.
He was
going to
kill her, right.
So.
Right, no, I'm just saying, yeah, you but just like in...
Yeah, in general, I get
yeah,
what you're
in general
saying.
Situations, yes.
Now, Carrie said that she did not die from the first cut, and he continued to drag her into the brush down to a creek. He ran up to his truck, which was in the middle of the road, and it was still running. Somehow, no one heard or saw anything during this chaotic and atrocious murder. Carrie went back to the creek, and he decapitated Joey. Now, I will say, this next couple sentences here, it's going to get a little gnarly. Okay. I mean, this already has been, but... He removed the duct tape from her wrists and head, then climbed into the water and tried to conceal her body under some reeds and other vegetation. He took her head and washed the blood from her face and hair in the creek. After that, he said, quote, just kind of looked at it a couple times, didn't do anything with it, basically just kind of amazed at what I'd done. Carrie said he didn't hunt or fish because he couldn't stand gutting dead animals. Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, what?
Oh, he says that even the sight of roadkill repulsed him, and he has to look away when he sees a dead animal on the road.
But you can remove
comfortable.
Someone's head.
Yes.
And taking their life, and you can't gut a fish, but you can remove a whole human being's head.
So you're gonna have to sit me down and explain this to me, and give me a real strong cocktail, because... I don't understand.
No. No, I don't either.
Mm-hmm. When it came to cutting Joey's head off, he said, quote, didn't bother him a bit. He even considered cutting her up into little pieces. Carrie said he washed Joey's face because he wanted to see her. He knew he couldn't keep her whole body, but he did consider keeping her head,
oh,
which
God.
He himself thought was weird, because he wasn't much of a, quote, trophy hunter. Once he decided that he could not keep her head, he put it in the creek face up, but then decided to turn it face down. He said he did that because he didn't want to scare anybody who might discover it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So face down is not scary, but face up would be.
I see a floating head
I'm
in
scared.
Any body of water.
Yes.
I am beyond scared. Uh-huh. I am like pants shitting, losing mind status.
Especially when it's not attached to
Are
a body.
Are you kidding? Oh God, and I freaking hate how casual he is about saying all of this.
I agree. He said he always kept a kit with him, which included a gun, a knife, a roll of duct tape, and a camera.
So he kept a murder kit.
Yes, he sure did. Carrie claimed that he got no sexual or emotional thrill from killing. It was just something he had to do when it was all over because he had, quote, nowhere to keep them.
Definitely not in any hidey holes.
Whoa. I didn't expect that to come back.
That still sticks in my brain, okay? I still think about the fucking hidey holes.
Yes. He said he was well aware that he left footprints and tire tracks at the scene. He realized later that he had also lost his sunglasses during the struggle, which was the pair of broken sunglasses that the investigators found on Joey's porch in the first episode. During the interview, Reinick asked Carrie if he felt bad. Would he be willing to write an apology letter? Would he undo the crimes if he could? He said he would undo all the murders if he could, but he was not ready to write an apology letter.
I don't believe that.
No, he's full of
shit.
Not
even a little bit.
No. Word eventually came back from the U.S. attorney that they would not be meeting Carrie's demands, Who could have seen that coming? He was not getting child pornography.
Wow, the cops weren't going to put a bunch of child pornography in front of him?
So strange. Reinick broke the news to Carey, but let him know that he had already confessed to the, quote, "we had fun with this" letter.
Right.
And he was like, you know, we already most likely have your DNA and evidence.
And he told them, too, they got the sunglasses and stuff, don't, yeah. But, like, he literally told them details that nobody else knew.
Exactly. He sure did. Carey said, quote, "my DNA is not on that letter." Reinick asked how he could know that. Didn't he write the letter? Carey said, quote, "let's put it this way. My handwriting is not on the letter." Reinick put an effort into getting him to talk about the other murders. He said he could make sure that he helped his family if he did. They sat in a long silence. Carey leaned back in his chair, looked at him, and then he said, "let's do it." He talked about the letter and provided the reason his DNA would not be linked to it. He altered his handwriting on the note, and he paid a kid at a Jack in the Box restaurant in Modesto $5 for a saliva sample.
Oh my God, please don't ever do that. I don't care how much money you're being offered. There is a really bad reason.
Well, I have no idea how old this child was or like where the parents are here.
Think about it though. I mean, like, if you're like a 12-year-old kid or something, you're like 13, you're like in high school and you're just like chilling at McDonald's or something, and somebody's like, "listen, I just need a swab of spit. Will you do it for like $10?
For
like,
sure.
Shit. But you're what a kid. If it's
like a little kid, you know?
That's true.
You have no idea.
No, that's very true. I guess I just assumed that it was going to be like
an older one.
Like a teenager, like a 12, 13-ish area, because like that sounds like something that age group would just be like, "well, sure, I could use the $10.
And it very well, it was $5.
Oh, shit, sorry, five, my bad.
It very well could have been. He actually told this child that he was facing a paternity test and he wanted to avoid responsibility for the child.
See, and that would...
So it probably is someone a little older.
That is absolutely, like, something that age group would...
Yeah.
Be able to
fall into.
It would be like more believable for them. Yeah. Yeah.
He used the saliva to seal the envelope and he also used it for the stamp. On the page in the notepad, on top of the one that he used to write the "we had fun with this one" letter, he wrote some random names and words. He pressed really hard so that they would leave an impression on the page underneath.
Yep.
The FBI had noticed this indented writing on the letter. Carey recited some of the things that he wrote, and they were Hispanic names, Mexican food items, and other things that he just made up.
Just, like, throw them off?
That's exactly it.
Yeah, so they see writing on there, like, oh, this has got to have something to do with it. Yeah, okay,
yeah. Now, with this piece of information, I mean, nobody could just guess this, you know, that right. There was random words indented in the paper. So it's obvious that Carey is the guy here. He said that he had been carefully watching TV forensic shows on Ted Bundy and other serial killers for quite a while. And he took mental notes on what led to them getting caught.
Damn, and I think about that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
As we sit and watch him, I'm just like, I know that people are using this for the wrong reasons.
Exactly. I mean, that's with anything, though. He knew that the indented writing would throw investigators off his trail, and he said, quote, "Ted Kaczynski gave me the idea for the envelope. He sent the letter because he did not want Julie lying outside in the elements, so he wanted her body to be found." And for anybody that doesn't know, Ted Kaczynski was also known as the Unabomber, who injured and killed people by mailing bombs.
Yep.
He sent letters to several national papers, and the FBI had his manifesto posted in the Washington Post, and his writings were recognized. So that's what Carey was apparently studying. He said the attack on the tourists at Cedar Lodge happened the day after Valentine's Day. He was gone most of the day because he was at his girlfriend's house. She had two daughters, and they were his original intended victims. On Valentine's Day, he tried to call his girlfriend because he was feeling lonely. But she didn't answer. The next day, February 15th, he went over to her property to do some repairs. They had an on-again, off-again type relationship, and she also dated other men. Carrie said that he didn't really like his girlfriend, but he liked her daughters, who were 8 and 11 years old.
Oh, gross!
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Oh my God.
I wish I was.
Fucking disgusting.
Reinick asked what his fantasy was, and he said, quote, kill the mother and rape the daughters.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
So.
This is a nightmare.
We will be vomiting after this episode, thank you. He did not want to have sex with his girlfriend. He wanted to force her two daughters to have sex with each other. Then he would rape them. After he was done, he would kill them.
I actually didn't think you could make it worse.
And here we are.
And you did.
Yeah. Carrie admitted that he was just using his girlfriend to get to her daughters, and he fantasized about the girls when he tried to have sex with his girlfriend. One night, his girlfriend mentioned that her electricity was out, and she was using tiki torches for light. She had another boyfriend who was away that night, so Carrie was going to show up unannounced. He wanted to use the torches to burn the house down when he was done with everything, but he couldn't find the house she was living in. He later realized that he did not have a weapon with him, so that's when he decided he should be more prepared and put a kill kit together. He said he didn't necessarily intend to kill his girlfriend on Valentine's Day if he was able to get through to her, but it was just always in his mind.
Oh, he didn't intend to kill anybody so far, but...
it just happens.
Right.
Whoops. The next day, after he finished the repairs for her, his girlfriend made dinner for him and her daughters. As he was preparing to leave her home, he decided not to carry out his plan because he liked the girls and took pity on them because they were so young, which I call complete bullshit on that. And he later admitted that he was going to carry out the plan eventually. So he's like back and forth on this, okay? But a man who lived as a caretaker on the property came by and Carrie got nervous. If this man had not been there, he would have gone through with it. He gets scared off anytime there's somebody else there.
That gave me chills when you said that, though.
Yeah.
That's the universe, you know, trying.
Absolutely. Carrie's girlfriend was later interviewed by the FBI, and she said she had only been intimate with Carrie on two occasions. She confirmed that he had a problem maintaining an erection, and he was never able to reach climax. He seemed to get real frustrated, and he was ashamed by this. The last time that they attempted sex was right before the attack on the tourists at the lodge, and he experienced this same problem, and then asked her to perform oral sex on him instead, but that did not work either. Carrie went back to the Cedar Lodge and was deeply frustrated, so he decided to relax in the hot tub for a while, but the water was green and dirty. He cleaned it, but by the time he finished, it was past closing hour for the pool area, so he went for a walk instead. He noticed four young girls staying at the lodge and decided to do some of his research. There were only two cars in the entire parking lot that night. The one the group of four girls arrived in and the red Pontiac Grand Prix that Carol Sund had rented.
Can I just, like, really quick say that it is very freaking weird that he, so to speak, researched, but also so did, what was it, Ken? Is that his name? From Stephen?
Oh, yes.
He also did that.
Yeah, because he was following people around. Yeah, and stalking
he sat
them.
And crept and decided which boys he wanted to take.
Yeah,
and then put a plan into action. And it's very weird that both of them did the same thing, where they both kind of did their like own research shit. Like,
yeah,
where they like sat and watched from a distance until they decided it was time.
There is extremely odd similarities. Yeah, in these cases.
Just, as you were saying, and I was just like, oh, I remember you saying that with him also, and I was, that's really weird.
And they both, of course, are lurking around the same exact areas.
Right.
You know?
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Mm-hmm. It's real spooky.
That is, yeah.
Carrie walked by the room where the four, oh wait, Kenneth Parnell. There you go.
Thank
it
you.
It came to me.
I did say Ken. I was
you
right.
You did. You were right.
I was there.
And I knew you were right.
You know it's an intense story when the names stick in my head that vividly.
Yeah, that never happens.
No, it's very rare, actually. I'm terrible with names.
Carrie walked by the room where the four girls were staying, but he could not see in the room because the room had a small, opaque bathroom window that was facing the parking lot. He had seen a man with the girls the previous night, so he ultimately decided not to target them because he could not confirm if they were alone or not. He walked to the 500 building where the Grand Prix was parked, and the curtain to room 509 was open about a foot, so he could see Julie and Sylvina in bed watching TV, and Carol was propped up in another bed reading a book.
I swear to God, I won't even let hotel curtains have like a single millimeter.
Ew, no.
Like, they have to be covered.
Mm-hmm. Everything's locked down. So he looks in and he sees a mother and two daughters, which matches his original plan. There was no one else in the building, so if they screamed, it would not be heard. Carrie said that he had been watching the guests at the lodge for an entire year as his potential targets. He had access to the master key that opened every room.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
So he had gone to the office to get the key when he decided to clean the pool, and he might need to get into room 509 with this key. But he didn't want anyone to know that he took it. So he went back to the office and pretended to drop it back in the drawer. He went to his room to collect his kit, which included duct tape, rope, a gun, and a large serrated knife, and he headed over to the 500 building. Instead of using the key to enter the room, he actually concocted a new plan. He started knocking on all of the doors that were surrounding this one, and he...
To make sure nobody else was there?
No. Oh. He knew no one else was there. So what he was doing is he wanted them to hear him knocking on these other doors. And he would say, there's a leak in the wing.
So they'd be comfortable opening the door.
Yeah. So he would say, hey, there's a leak and I'm looking for the source. And he would announce that he's maintenance. And then he would open the doors with his key. And he would go inside each one long enough to make it sound like he was actually checking on something until he got closer and closer to their room. But Carol, when he got to her door, she actually knew something was off and she refused to open the door. She spoke to Carrie through the window and refused three separate times to let him in. He let her know that there was water seeping into the sheetrock and they needed to move into another room. If he checked and there was no damage, then they could just stay put. But she still resisted. He said, fine, then I'm going to go get the manager. And that's when she finally opened the door. Once he was inside, he said he needed to look in the fan duct, and he went to the bathroom, climbed on the toilet, and pulled down the fan to make it all look super legit. He put the fan back in place and came out of the bathroom with his gun drawn. He said he was desperate for money to get out of the country, and he asked for their money and car keys. Carol reached for her purse, but he ordered her back to the bed, bound and gagged her with duct tape, and did the same to the girls. He carried Julie and Sylvina to the bathroom and set one on the floor and one in the bathtub. He went back to Carol, tied her hands to her feet with rope, kneeled on her back, and strangled her to death with a rope. Carrie said he felt absolutely nothing when he murdered her. No anger, no rage, nothing, no emotion at all. He described himself as killing her, quote, nonchalantly. He did complain about how difficult it actually is physically to strangle somebody, and it hurt the nerves in his hands from pulling on the rope so hard.
Strangling is one of the, like, definitely the worst for me because I know that it takes a very, very long time.
And a lot of strength.
Yep.
And a lot of time to change your mind and stop what you're doing. It's not quick pull of a trigger. It actually takes time and effort. But just the way he talks about it, like, I was so nonchalant.
Everything has been nonchalant the entire time he's been talking.
He feels nothing about this.
He's just like, oh, well, you know, that it's fine. I just didn't want to do that because of this. It's like, he talks like it's just another day.
Like going to a grocery store.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you would describe that. Like, oh, I didn't really feel anything. I just had to go to the grocery store today.
It's difficult to listen to.
I know. I agree.
Yeah, what did he say? Oh, the thing about the trophies.
Yeah, he is not a trophy hunter. Well,
I almost took the head, but then I was like, I'm not a trophy hunter. Like,
right. Where am I going to keep it?
It's just so, I hate the nonchalantness behind it. Like, it's just, no, stop.
Yeah.
Just, no.
Well, he carried Carol's body out in a sheet and placed her in the trunk of the rental vehicle. He wasn't concerned about being seen with the body in the parking lot because it was late and there were no guests nearby. There was nobody. He did unscrew the light bulb in the trunk to make sure that he wasn't casting a light on what he was doing, though. He said he carefully placed Carol's body in the trunk, not out of respect. He wanted to make sure she was carefully positioned so there was room for other bodies.
For the other ones, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Carrie went back to the room and brought Julie and Sylvina into the bedroom. He assumed the girls were sisters and told them he had taken their mother to the room next door. He was not sure if he had shut the bathroom door all the way when he killed Carol, and he could hear Sylvina crying while he did it. Carrie cut the clothing off Julie and Sylvina with a knife, and that's why there were little pieces of fabric left behind in the room, which the investigators were having such a hard time figuring
out.
Mm-hmm. Carrie said he wanted to rape the girls, but he realized that Sylvina had her period. He tried to force the girls to have sex with each other, but Sylvina refused and she kept crying. Carrie was annoyed by her tears and the fact that she had her period was a, quote, turnoff for him.
So sorry that a woman's body can't help itself.
Right.
How dare we?
What horrible timing for you. So he led her into the bathroom and strangled her with the rope and left her body in the bathtub.
Oh, this is rough.
Mm-hmm. He went back out to Julie, but he heard Sylvina making noises. So he went back into the bathroom and she was still breathing, which is absolutely horrifying to me. He covered her nose with duct tape until her breathing stopped. He sexually assaulted Julie for hours and had his typical issues with dysfunction. He said for the first time in his life, though, he felt like he was in control. He took her gag off so she could comply with his demands, and she asked if he was going to kill her, and he did not respond. She also asked to go to the bathroom, but he couldn't do that because Sylvina's body was in there. So he used his key to take her to the room next door, and while she was in there, he went back and moved Sylvina's body to the trunk of the Grand Prix. While she was in the bathroom, he forced Julie to shave her pubic hair because he had fantasies about prepubescent girls.
And is that...
That's why...
What he's talking about earlier?
Yes, okay. That is why he said shaved pubic hair. He tied her up so that she couldn't get away, and he disconnected the phone. Around 5 a.m., he decided that they probably should get out of there. Carrie went back to room 509 to clean up. He packed the women's bags, loaded everything into the back seat of the rental car, and made it look like they checked out. He put wet towels on the bathroom floor so it would appear like they showered before leaving in a hurry. And he took that Jerry Maguire movie that they rented out of the VCR and put it on the dresser. He figured he had left some trace evidence behind. Maybe he shed some hair on the bedspreads. So he decided he would have to come back later to clean up more. And remember, in the first one, I had mentioned that they do not do regular cleaning at this place.
Right.
So he would actually have that extra time. He's not rushed here. He was afraid that employees might be asked to provide samples. So he shaved off all of his body hair after the crime so they would have nothing to compare it to. Since Julie had cooperated with Carrie, he did not want to end her life right away. He felt a bond with her.
Right away. Didn't want to end her life right away.
He thought he loved her. Which I assure you, he did not. He wanted to keep her, but he just didn't see how that would be possible. He told Julie he was going to take her somewhere else and that he wasn't going to hurt her. She was naked and wrapped in a pink blanket from one of the beds, and he led her out to the rental car. He put her in the passenger seat and put her seatbelt on, which is also one of those other weird things to me. That he's seatbelting her in.
When,
like, why do you give a shit?
To keep her safe when
you're gonna kill her anyways.
Yeah.
She was not gagged, but bound loosely by her hands, and she was briefly left alone while he dropped off the master key. When he came back and she was still in the car, in his mind, he believed that was proof that she cared about him and wanted to be with him.
I was worried you were gonna say that.
He headed west on Highway 140 to Mariposa, then caught Route 49 north. He said he didn't know where to go. He just kept driving. He asked Julie questions about herself, and he found out later that everything she said was a lie. She told him her name was Sarah. Once the sun was starting to come up, Carrie knew he couldn't keep her much longer. So he pulled into the parking lot for the Vista Point above Don Pedro Lake. There's a hiking trail that veers off from the parking lot and cuts across the ridge. He carried Julie down the trail in his arms and said it was, quote, like a groom carrying a bride over the threshold.
I need to stop myself from gagging here.
I actually, at this point, had to put the book down and walk away for a few and take a little break.
Yeah.
Just not a lot that can be said. He said he carried her because it was cold and she didn't have any shoes on. He felt nothing as he discussed the other murders, but he cried when he talked about Julie. He stopped along the trail, spread the blanket out, raped her again, and said he wished that he could keep her, but he knew he could not. He told her she had a good chance of getting away when he first emerged from the bathroom at Cedar Lodge because the gun wasn't loaded. I don't know if that's true, but to tell her something like that...
I was just gonna say, why the hell would you say something like that? Like, I know that you have no conscience, obviously, but... come on.
I don't think it's true because I think he was prepared for this whole thing. But either way, it doesn't matter. To say that, oh God, and give her that and have her with that in her head as like her dying moments, like, oh, you could have gotten away.
That's like, honestly, a form of torture that I can't even wrap my brain around.
He took his knife out, told her he loved her, and he wished he could keep her, and then he slit her throat.
And then making that the last fucking word she hears before she is...
she shouldn't have to hear that. Gross.
Are you... okay. Yes, I need to breathe.
Carrie said, quote, she was a very likable girl. She was very calm. He says that she made a hand gesture when he was killing her. And he interpreted this as...
it was okay?
Like, yeah, her asking him to finish her
off. Holy hell.
So he did, and then he looked away, and she died 15 to 20 seconds later. The way that he looks at things is just so twisted. Which, I mean, I get it. He's a murderer, but still. He said, quote, "I didn't want her to suffer the way the other two did." After he murdered her, he spread her legs in a sexual pose just as he had done with Joey's body. He removed the duct tape from her hands and hid it under a log. He cut some branches and brush to cover the body, then tossed the knife as far as he could down the hill. He stood over her and took in the view, then headed back to the rental car. He opened the trunk and cut the nightclothes off Carol's body because he didn't want it to appear that she had been kidnapped from Cedar Lodge. He cut the duct tape off Carol and Sylvina because he knew his fingerprints could be on it. He did forget the pink blanket on the hillside, but he went back to get it, threw it in a plastic bag, and tossed it off the side of the highway. Another car pulled into the lot just as he was leaving. He stopped at a gas station to get something to drink and pulled around back to avoid the cameras. When he got back on the road, he was surrounded by highway patrol cars, but it was just a coincidence. It had nothing to do with him. He drove as far north as the New Maloney's Lake, a reservoir in the Stanislaus River. He was planning to drive the car with the bodies in the trunk off the boat ramp into the lake. But when he got there, there were some people fishing. He dumped a pillowcase from room 509 in a dumpster there, and it contained the women's clothes, the sheets from the motel, and the duct tape. He drove around for a while, but the wintry roads made it kind of difficult to find an area to stash the car. He found the road near Long Barn that ended in a clearing. He drove as far as he could go, wiped down the car with gloves from his kit, scattered some of the women's belongings on the hill around the car, such as Carol's purse, some rope, and Julie's shoes. He took out his pocket knife and carved into the hood of the rental car, quote, "We have Sarah." Due to the condition of the car, the FBI never saw the note that had been on there, but after his confession, they were able to find it.
Okay, because like I was actually going to ask you, I was like, I do not remember hearing about that.
Because it was torched so bad. He walked to Sierra Village to catch a bus home, but when he got there, he realized he did not wipe down the area in the trunk lid where he took the light bulb out, and he would miss the bus if he went back. He went and got some breakfast because, you know, now he's hungry after all of this murdering. Then he took $200 from Carol's wallet to get a cab. He had the driver drop him off at the Yosemite Lodge in the park. He was on call that night in case there was a maintenance emergency at Cedar Lodge, so he had to be back before 5 p.m. When he got home, he was too exhausted to think about cleaning rooms 509 and 510, but he was able to do so the following night, which this is also really crazy to me that he's thinking of all these extra things like, oh, I actually got to go back and wipe this down. I got to clean up these rooms. But he goes and works his normal job and his hours before even doing these things.
Right.
Having this hanging over his head.
No, I can always tell when somebody does not have anxiety because holy shit, that would eat me right up.
Oh my goodness.
Because you were saying earlier, you were like, oh, well, he has time. He's not like in a huge hurry. And I was like, no. Like, if, like I were in a situation like this, obviously never, but, like, if I were in a situation like this, I would be, like, freaking out. Like, somebody's definitely going to be there today. This is going to be the one day they come and clean the rooms. Like, there is no way my brain would be able to shut that off.
The amount of stress, for example, that I get when I cannot remember if I unplugged my straightener.
Oh, I know.
And then I have to think about it and freak out. And call people. Yep. Can you go check? And they're like, yeah, you did unplug it.
Yep.
Because it will eat me alive.
Same.
And, oh, okay. I can't. When he went back to the rooms, he noticed some blood on one of the pillows and in the bathtub where Sylvina had been. He was aware of luminol testing, so he scrubbed the tub with bleach and changed the sheets, but He forgot to replace one of the pillowcases and the pink blanket he took to wrap around Julie. He was asked how he knew to do all of this, and he said, quote, "I watch the Discovery Channel," which I do too, but not for that reason, Carrie. Right. Even though he felt that he had thoroughly cleaned the car, he decided to go back and torch it. So he drove over with a can of gasoline on the night of February 18th. He poured the gas inside over the back seat and threw the match in. He took off running up the hill and he heard a loud explosion. He got 3/4 of the way back to his truck when he realized he left the gas can behind. So he had to run back and get it. The fire set off the Grand Prix's horn, so it was blaring. He ran back to his vehicle and hid behind a tree as a snowplow driver was passing. He went back to get the credit card insert from Carol's wallet, and then he drove to Modesto and threw it out the window as he passed through an intersection.
Okay, actually, this really does kind of sound like Heidi Hole, dude, because did he not, like, forget 5,000 things and, like,
yes, at every place? Scene, yeah.
Yeah, and he had to keep going back over and over. Like,
sure thinking, did.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's exactly the crap that this dude's doing.
It is. And it's
he's
like,
oh, I forgot this.
Over the span of a couple days, like, he keeps going back over and over and over to change things and then forgets something again. He wanted investigators to think that the person that committed the crime was from Modesto. He was nervous for the first few weeks after the murders, so he ended up losing 15 pounds. He was interviewed once by the FBI, and he thought that they were going to get him right away. Like, that's a wrap. He monitored the news closely and was thrilled to find out that other people had been blamed for his crimes. Reinick asked Carrie if he would have stopped killing if he had not been caught, and he immediately shook his head no. He would not have stopped, and he almost killed again before he was picked up.
Finally, something I believe out of his mouth.
Exactly, yeah. And that's why I said, too, like, if Joey had not fought back, he still would have killed her.
Right.
Because he's saying, like, no, I would have kept going. He liked it. After he packed up his stuff and left the Cedar Lodge, he actually drove to his girlfriend's house. And if you recall, her and her 2 daughters were the original intended victims. Even though he initially said, oh no, I changed my mind. I felt bad. I wasn't going to hurt them. He got to her place at 12:45 a.m. and she said it was unusual for him to show up without an invitation, especially when it was so late. He told her his car had broken down and it was at a friend's house. So she's like, okay. She invited him to stay the night. But her other boyfriend was there. Once Carrie realized this, he left and decided not to attack them that night. The entire confession lasted 6 hours and he was arrested and taken to jail. Reinick handed Carrie a pen and paper and he told him to write some apology letters to the victims. He chose to only write a letter to Julie. And I have it here. And I'm so sorry. He wrote, quote, "Dear Julie, there are not enough words in the universe or days left in my life to express to you how sorry I am for what I've done to you, your mother, and your friend. My weakness to control my evil desires has led us both to this crossroad. You, on one hand, have crossed over to a place of which I can now only dream of going, and I'm going someplace far worse."
Well, that's fucking true.
"My thoughts of you are of a very sweet young woman who had a wonderful life ahead of her, but as it turns out, I destroyed any hope of that. No more days with your family and friends, no more breaths of fresh air, no more sun shining on your face, no more dreams of light to be. All of it thrown away like yesterday's trash. My memories of your last seconds will haunt me till the day I die, and rightfully so. The things I told you before I ended your life are things I have never been able to tell anyone else. Perhaps it was a fear of rejection, or perhaps it was just plain fear of love, an emotion I have never experienced from anyone but my parents. But I can't blame my emotion or lack of for what I did. I know right from wrong, and I don't think that I'm insane, but there is a craziness that lurks in my brain. Thoughts I have tried to subdue as long as I can remember. I'm just sorry that you were there when the years of fantasizing my darkest dreams became a reality in the flesh.
I know you're waiting for a response.
No, no. Okay, I was not like, necessarily. Your face looked like something was going to come out.
Yeah, I just... That... It wasn't... Oh, my God. That was not... That was, like, more of a fantasy letter.
It's a love letter to
than
her.
Than an
like, I'm
apology.
Not
going to
see like, sun shining on your face.
I knew that, like, he wasn't going to be, like, giving a genuine apology, obviously, but... It's just, like, that was literally just, like, him talking about basically how he got to bring out his fantasy with her.
Exactly. Like, it has nothing to do with, wow, I'm such a piece of shit and I'm really sorry for what I've done and what I'm going to put your family through.
And, like, by the way, you're never going to get to feel sunshine on your face or take a breath of fresh air anymore ever again because I took that from you. But guess what? I can still do that.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I know. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Carrie had not been on anyone's radar during the initial parts of the investigation. When investigators went back to the lodge to collect blankets in May, the manager had him use his master key to help them. The killer was helping to gather evidence from his own crime. I'm sure that was, like, so thrilling for him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to be involved in that.
You know it.
Reinick kept his word to Carrie, and he did drive to his parents' home the next morning to deliver the news. Del and Kay recognized Reinick from the news about the Joey Armstrong case. So before he could even tell them anything, they said he didn't do it. He would never do anything wrong.
They probably just saw a freaking cop car rolling up and were like,
not
please,
again.
Please, no, not again. Yeah.
No, they've been through it, you know. Reinick explained that, no, he provided a full confession, and they cried the entire time. He did assure them that Carrie chose to confess and got nothing for it. So he did it for the right reasons. Carrie agreed to drive around to the crime scenes with investigators to show them everything he did and find other evidence that he had hid. He still claims that the Sund Peloso murders were his first ones ever, but he said that a year prior, in the summer of 1998, he planned to attack two preteen Finnish girls who were staying at the Cedar Lodge. And he tried to enter their room at 2 a.m. with his master key, but for some reason, it didn't work.
Because the universe was telling him to stop!
Right. Please look at the signs. Do not murder. A woman who was with the girls woke up and heard the lock being jiggled. She looked out the window and banged on the glass, so he did leave. She called security, and the security called Carrie to go check things out.
Oh, no!
Yeah. Just 2 weeks before he got caught, he saw a group of women on the Merced River near the 25-mile-per-hour beach. As he approached them with his gun, a man walked up to them, so he left. And you know what, Hannah? Now that you've put it in my mind about Dennis Rader, BTK.
Oh.
Okay. He, if I recall correctly, every time there was like a man involved, he got out of there.
Because somebody came over to a house.
Yeah.
There was a house that like he was at one point and a dude came in and like messed things up for him. Yes.
Yeah, he did not like weird. When there was someone like that involved, so yeah.
Oh, there's a lot of synchronicities in this one.
Ooh.
That is weird.
Yeah. He said that when the Rangers questioned him shortly after discovering Joey's body and he did not want them to search his backpack, it's because he had his kill kit inside.
Oh.
So while they searched his vehicle, he quietly
slipped the kill kit out.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's okay. Yep. Now it all checks.
So they're waiting for the warrant. he's holding on to the bag and they're busy. And he takes out the gun, knife, and gloves from the backpack, and he was able to hide them under rocks and logs that were nearby. When Carrie was being interviewed by Ted Rollins, KNTV reporter, he said he wanted Los Angeles producers to be contacted because he wanted a movie of the week to be made about his story.
Oh, did you?
He sure did, just like his brother. The reporter asked Carrie if he would have continued killing, and he said, definitely. He would have continued to kill until he was caught or killed himself. Unfortunately, since Stephen and Carrie are brothers, like I was talking about earlier, their stories will always be linked together, and the media portrayed Carrie as, quote, the other son. He didn't have his own story. It became an addition to Stephen's, and it began to overshadow the hero Stephen was for saving himself and Timmy White after they were both kidnapped.
Yeah, and you know what? It does suck because you, like, don't want him to get what he wants and have his attention, but you're also like, yeah, I see, as you're saying, like, I can absolutely see how people would connect them.
Of course.
In my brain, it is completely separate because, like, it is just too, it's his brother, but I mean, he didn't even grow up with him. Like,
no,
he was not even in the house. Like, it's entirely different in my brain.
Yeah. And Stephen was gone for 7 years.
Right.
And then he didn't even stay at the house very long once he got back. He was basically an adult.
Yeah. No, exactly. I mean, like, he didn't even grow up with him, really. It's completely separate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree. During real video footage of Stephen doing a news conference just days after his return, you can see Carrie standing behind him in the background watching, and his face is completely emotionless as Stephen's talking about his return. And then Carrie just suddenly turns around and walks away as Stephen's talking to everybody.
I'm gonna have to definitely watch that.
It's really, really interesting. The writer of the TV movie interviewed Carrie. He said he didn't get along very well with Stephen when he came back. He was just a normal kid who did what anyone would do, yet he was labeled a hero.
He didn't do what anyone would do.
I know.
Are you kidding me?
I know. It's just Carrie's view, which is silly.
And he was a child that was able to do that. I mean, like,
that's brave as shit.
That is something that a lot of adults couldn't even do.
Right. To get that courage to go, are you kidding?
And to save yourself and somebody else.
Yeah. This ate Carrie up inside, though, and his father, Del, told him that he wasn't acting like he wanted to be part of the family. He said he didn't need to be loved that much, but he would have liked a little bit, which I do think that is very sad to hear a child say. So Carrie is saying, like, his parents did not love him the way that he felt he needed.
Well, I mean, yeah, especially with the Stephen situation and them, like, being off worrying about him.
They didn't know how to navigate it.
Right. And like you had said, they, like, I think you said at one point that he literally said, my real son, when he was talking about Stephen. So it's like, I can imagine that definitely wasn't great for him. So, like, that aspect is sad, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But him,
yeah,
going off and murdering people because of it is not the way to handle it.
No. Carrie Stainer sent a letter from jail to a Fresno newspaper explaining that he wanted to sell his story so that he could pay, quote, as much restitution to my victims' families as possible. Criminologist Mike Rustigan said, quote, anything a serial killer says is suspect. A guy that has the capacity to behead a victim, to ruthlessly abduct them and mislead the police, I don't think that he's now suddenly struck with pangs of remorse.
Yep.
So, I agree with you. A California newspaper published a letter from Carrie, quote, in response to J.L. Richards' letter, August 11th, I have to say, J.L., you're right. Way too much attention has been placed on me. The media blitz to uncover the how and why someone like me could become a murderer is very unnerving. Any public sympathy should not be directed towards me, but to my victims and their family. As for my thirst for notoriety, if anyone knows the tainted picture of reality that a made-for-TV movie paints, it's me. After my brother's movie aired, I was disgusted. I wished that it had never been made.
That is really rough.
I mean, that tells you right there. He was...
Yeah, no, it definitely does.
Just overridden with jealousy over the attention his brother got.
Oh, people shouldn't have sympathy for me. Yeah, you're damn straight.
Right. The people closest to Carrie said that he was very creative and artsy, calm, and serene. His sister, Corey, says he was always unwell mentally. He was happiest when he was isolated. When he was 7, he remembers sitting in the front seat of his parents' station wagon, looking into a grocery store at a female cashier. He would fantasize about tying them up and killing them.
At how old?
7.
Whoa.
Just sitting in your parents' vehicle thinking about that. Like, you would never think as you're grocery shopping that your child is outside in the car thinking about killing people.
That's a lot to comprehend.
It's really spooky. In September of 2000, a deal was struck where Carrie Stainer was allowed to plead to life in prison without the possibility of parole instead of getting the death penalty. Joey's mother, Leslie Armstrong, told a reporter that she wavered between her Christian beliefs and wanting to, quote, personally beat him to death. She decided to take the deal to avoid the prolonged appeals, and she knew that his death would not bring her daughter back. She said that everyone loved Joey. She had the highest respect for her daughter, and she was exquisite. The state proceeded with its capital case in June of 2001. As the confession played, Carrie plugged his ears and cried. Sylvina's father was so overwhelmed by the confession that he lunged towards Carrie at one point. Carrie was tried in federal court for Joey Armstrong's murder since it occurred on federal land. To avoid a possible death sentence, he pleaded guilty to premeditated first-degree murder, felony first-degree murder, kidnapping resulting in death, and attempted aggravated sexual abuse resulting in death. During sentencing, he cried and delivered an apology. He said, quote, "I wish I could take it back, but I can't. I wish I could tell you why I did such a thing, but I don't even know myself. I'm so sorry. I wish there was a reason, but there isn't. It's senseless. If there is a God in heaven, I pray for his forgiveness. I cannot expect any forgiveness from Mrs. Armstrong or her family for taking Joey from them. I cannot even ask forgiveness from my own family, who I have hurt so deeply and who have already suffered so much. I have to live with the terrible reality of what I have done. I'm very sorry that everyone else must live with it too. I'm going to take all the head shaking as you do not buy this apology, Hannah."
It made me want to lunge at him also.
Okay.
Yeah.
In state court, he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity for the murders of Carol Sund, Julie Sund, and Sylvina Peloso. His lawyers claimed that the Stainer family had a history of sexual abuse and mental illness, manifesting itself not only in the murders, but also his obsessive compulsive disorder and his request to be provided with child pornography in return for his confession. Dr. Jose Arturo Silva testified that Carrie had obsessive compulsive disorder, mild autism, and paraphilia, which is the experience of intense sexual arousal to atypical objects, situations, fantasies, behaviors, or individuals. He was found sane and convicted of 3 counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances and 1 count of kidnapping by a jury on August 27th of 2002. He was sentenced to death at San Quentin State Prison in California, but California's last execution was held in 2006. So that is where he currently remains.
Wow, 2006.
Yep.
That is not that long ago. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not that crazy long ago. I mean, it is because we're in 2023.
Yeah, but it isn't. I get your point. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically he is on death row, even though they have not done any of those since 2006.
Interesting.
So if they were to pick it back up.
Then he would. Okay.
Otherwise, he just remains as is.
Wow.
So.
That one was a lot.
It's a pretty mind-blowing case.
I mean, yeah, you definitely blew my mind apart, but, oh man, that was a lot.
Yeah.
I am still in shock from you dropping the bomb that it was his brother. It was Steven's brother. Right. I still haven't gotten over that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm still in shock about that. But, like, yes, like, please don't group them together and let his shittiness overpower Steven's amazingness and his, you know, his, like, ability to be able to save himself and Timmy?
Yeah, Timmy White.
Holy shit! Uh-huh. I have remembered almost every name from that one.
I know.
That's weird. My God. But, like, yeah, I mean, oh my God. Wow, this was a gross one.
Yep, it sure was.
Yeah. And, yeah, that one was rough.
Just his disgusting attitude about it.
That's exactly.
It really gets to me. And the way that he, like, decided that he was in love with Julie and, oh, I carried her over the threshold like a bride.
And she gestured to me so that I knew to take her out the rest of the way.
Yeah.
No.
It's just, nauseating.
All of it. Like I said, I literally just got out of the shower before we started recording this and I'm like feeling like I need to go get back in the shower because I just feel disgusting after hearing all that.
Yeah, it's real gross.
Yeah.
So there you go. No more bombshells of doing another case on the Stainer family. Like, we are done here.
Promise?
Yeah. Although, technically, what? No. I'm just saying we could have gotten into all of the hairy details of his parents.
Oh, yeah.
And all of the abuse in the family. But
right.
I think we're good on that.
No,
thank
I think,
you.
Yeah. Yep,
we've
yep.
had enough. Yep. So we'll move on next week.
All right.
All right. So make sure to follow us on any of your podcast apps. Tell us the stories you want to hear. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Leave us a 5-star review if you love us. Tell your friends. Tell your cats. Bye.